Welcome to Your Health Today. We're back at the University of Maryland Medical Center. We're taking you inside for an intimate look at this academic medical center where they heal, teach, discover, and care. We're about to rejoin our meeting from last week with Dr. Rajbara Sakar, who is Chief of Vascular Surgery here at the University of Maryland Medical Center. He's an internationally renowned vascular surgeon who's developing innovative treatments for vascular care. In part one, he tested my arteries. Now, he's about to test my veins. Talk about what the other things you're going to check and how they all work together.
We're going to look at the flow in your veins, in the legs. Veins bring blood back to the heart, right?
Arteries
take blood from the heart to different organs. Veins are different. Veins are pipes that carry blood back to the heart and to the lungs from throughout your body. The major vein problem that we see that's life-threatening is clots in the veins that can break off from immobility, trauma, pregnancy, or surgery. Those are the big four things that we see. And that breaks off and goes to your lungs. That can be potentially fatal. That's called a pulmonary embolism. Okay? And that's one thing that we're going to check for right now is a blood clot in your legs. Again, to show how simple and painless this test is.
So what I'm going to have you do is bend your knee and tip it towards me.
All right.
Like a frog. This is a typical way. We go from groin to ankle when we assess a leg, and we always look at both legs. Typically, you find DVT or blood clot in one leg, but we look at both because every now and then, the leg that you think is fine isn't. As a technologist, what I'm looking for when I look at your veins, your leg, is to see that those vein walls touch, they coapt. That tells me there's nothing in that vein, so chances are there's no thrombus in that vein that would be causing a blood clot. That would be a blood clot.
How's it look?
It looks really clear.
Looks okay, Mark.
Yes, he does.
Can we do some augmentation sound, Sue?
Sure.
So what we're going to hear now is the flow of blood in the veins, which is going to sound very different than what you heard in the arteries. Okay, because there's no pump, there's no heart on the vein side. And so one of the things that Sue is going to do is we're going to squeeze the leg below where she's scanning. And when you squeeze the leg, it makes the blood flow in the veins. And you're going to hear that. So that's the flow. Is that at rest?
Yes.
So we hear that. And that's the blood that's changing the venous blood flow with respiration. That's normal. Okay, and in a second, Sue is going to squeeze below. Just breathe normally now. So that noise that you heard was the rush of blood in the vein when she's squeezing below. If there was a blockage in the vein from a blood clot, you wouldn't hear that wave of blood going through. It's a real simple test, and it's easy to understand.
So you passed.
I passed. Who are the people who should come for tests like this? Are there groups and bodies of people, age groups, that should worry about this more than others?
I think if you are pregnant, if you have had recent surgery, or if you've recently had a long airplane ride, and you notice swelling and pain in your leg, you need to seek medical advice about that.
So there are people who you always hear say, she's perfectly healthy, they had a stroke, or something happened, and they aneurysm, they died. So how does that relate to, when people think about that, in terms of the issues you say are the precursors to these diseases?
Sure. In general, though, when you talk about people who had a stroke or heart attack, if you look at their medical history, there's usually at least one or more of those factors that I talked about. Again, diabetes, smoking, high blood pressure, high cholesterol. It is extremely rare for someone to have a heart attack or stroke with none of those factors. Now, it could be they're not paying attention to those factors. But I think if you look at those risk factors, they're usually there.
Varicose veins. Is that a medical disorder, or is this just a function of aging?
That's a good question. Roughly 10 to 30% of the population has varicose veins. It's hard to call something a medical disorder when one in three people in America is walking around with it. Adults are. And for most people, there are no symptoms. I think in my practice, because at the University of Maryland, we get the more complicated patients. I see patients whose varicose veins are hurting, or they're particularly unsightly, or they've had an episode of bleeding, or they're starting to have skin changes or leg swelling or pain. I think if you start having symptoms and you have varicose veins, you need to see a vascular specialist. And if the varicose veins are getting bigger and enlarging, I think you need to see someone. But in general, no, I don't think, I mean, it's hard, again, when one in three people in the country is walking around with it, it's hard to say it's a disease.
Great, Dr. Sarkar, thanks for your time. This is
sure. It's been a pleasure.
For more information on caring for your vascular health at the University of Maryland Medical Center, please log on to umm.edu/vascular or just call 410-328-5840. Welcome back. I'm Mark Steiner.
And I'm Anthony McCarthy.
We are going to cover a number of areas during the course of these next 2 hours. We're going to start by talking with the meetings taking place in Washington right now. President Obama has called the largest gathering of nations since the founding of the United Nations
Isn't
in 1945.
Something? Talk about a very important issue.
And we'll talk about that. Then we'll be meeting with someone whose Facebook arguments about racism and institutional racism in downtown Baltimore caught my attention. And Keith Snipes will be in studio talking about that. And then we will close out the 2 hours wondering whether this race to the top is a race to the top or something else and all that. But first, let's talk about what President Barack Obama is attempting to do around the issue of nuclear power and weaponry. Anthony, as we are both joined here by Robert Alvarez, who's a senior scholar at the Institute for Policy Studies, where he's an expert on the nuclear disarmament and energy policy, and served as senior policy advisor to the Secretary and Deputy Assistant Secretary for National Security and the Environment from 1993 to 1999. And Robert Alvarez, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Oh, thank you for having me on your show.
So this issue, then, we see this large, huge gathering, and it's going to do with Iran, North Korea, and Syria were invited. We're not invited. Israel was invited, but then pulled out.
Right.
We'll get to that in a minute. But talk about what you think the significance of this is, this whole question of whether or not the United States or anybody else can really clamp down on the possibility of nuclear weapons or the material needed to make bombs can be controlled.
Well, I think it's, you know, he's certainly doing something to raise public consciousness and awareness about this problem. But the issue of Gates guards and guns and all that stuff that comes, you know, improving nuclear security is really dealing kind of with a symptom and not with the root cause. And so, you know, and I think to a certain extent, President Obama has been trying to deal with the root cause. But, you know, as long as the United States and Russia possess these huge oversized nuclear arsenals and don't take any good faith steps to eliminate the weapons, it's very hard for the United States to say, do as I say, but not as I do. So, we have a long way to go here in terms of dealing with this. I think the issue of, you know, securing nuclear materials to make it harder for bad guys to get their hands on it is a commendable thing. But at the same time, I'm more concerned about countries acquiring nuclear weapons.
Right.
Than I am in individual subnational groups acquiring nuclear weapons.
Robert, this is Anthony McCarthy. I want to take our listeners back to last week when the president was in Prague and he signed the accord with the president of Russia. How significant, going into this summit, how significant was the accord that the president and Russia agreed to? I've been reading various accounts, and I guess it's depending on how you approach this issue. Some people say that the accord that was agreed to last week was not as significant as it was played in the press and in foreign policy circles. Other people saying it was a significant step in our new relationship with Russia.
Well, I think any effort that, especially after the last 8 years of the Bush administration, to go back to an era where, you know, we are going to try to get rid of nuclear weapons as opposed to holding on to them is a positive development. And I think that I think you have to look at this as something that not in and of itself is not the not the answer, but the beginning toward the beginnings of an answer.
Mm.
So I think that you know that, that it's a positive step. I don't think it's the you know the such a dramatic new change in where we were. I mean, what it's doing is putting things that were taken off track about 10 years ago is what's really going on here. And that's a positive thing. I mean, we've just lost so much time with this with previous administration, which was so regressive, that it's going to take a while to get back on the track, and this is one example of it.
Well, when you said earlier, Robert, about we have to deal with the root cause here, I mean, how does one this argument's been going on since I can remember, since I was a kid, about banning nuclear weapons, which is where we got the original peace sign from in the first place. So the question: how do you even begin to think about getting there when the Soviet Union, or excuse me, Russia and the United States have this huge body of weapons? That you have North Korea and Iran clearly developing some kind of weaponry, as most people will think they do. Israel having the weapons and never really admitting that they do. India and Pakistan, their own war around these weapons. This is not an issue you just kind of that anybody's really kind of figured out how to put their hands around.
Well, it's an issue that you can try to control and try to minimize or the problem. But I think that countries that have certain capabilities, especially if they are able to develop an infrastructure to build reactors, to have laboratories, to have trained scientists, have a latent capability to then make the leap into nuclear weapons. And all of these particular elements are available through the Atoms for Peace program, or the Peaceful Nuclear Atom, which nuclear power is, sort of the prime example. So now that Iran is getting very close to, people are afraid that Iran is getting very close to amassing the material to make nuclear weapons, it's no surprise now to see other countries in the Middle East wanting to get their hands on nuclear power plants all of a sudden,
right,
even though they don't need them. And I think this is a response to, if these guys are going to have the capability, we might as well have the option of having that capability too. So let's go and get this by claiming that we're going to generate electricity and build up an infrastructure to allow us to have this capability if we need it in the future. I mean, North Korea, I mean, their nuclear weapons program came out of facilities that were being promoted by the Atoms for Peace program and the open literature. So there are these sort of big contradictions that make it very hard. The superpowers, the former superpowers rather, having these very large, enormous nuclear arsenals that are still aimed at each other, and we still are going through targeting exercises of using these enormously, fantastically destructive weapons against each other. And at the same time, there's a lot of pressure to promote the technologies to make nuclear weapons available to other countries in the name of the peaceful atom. I mean, if you look at India, how did India acquire its nuclear weapons? It acquired it under the guise of the peaceful atom. So we have to come to terms with these things, and there's a sort of a, I don't know what you want to call it, cognitive dissonance about this, or we really have not been able to come to grips with. And one of the things has to do with the enormous influence that the nuclear establishment has on the U.S. government and our energy policy. I mean, 65% of the Department of Energy's budget is basically dedicated to its nuclear weapons complex, U.S. nuclear weapons complex. And then if you look more thoroughly at the amount of money that's being set aside for energy research and development, for real energy stuff, a big chunk of that, the single biggest chunk, is going to shore up the government's nuclear installations. So there is this very powerful pervasive influence within the U.S. government to hold on to its antiquated nuclear weapons and nuclear power infrastructure, which is largely government-owned, government-run. And it has a big impact because, you know, these are this is a lot of money flowing into areas of the country that dominate wage and benefit structures, and members of Congress are very keen on keeping all this stuff, all this money flowing, and we haven't been able to sort of shake any of that loose. I mean, the last time we had a really serious effort to try to shake loose of this was during the first Bush administration, Herbert Walker Bush, in the late 80s and early 90s, right after the Cold War. And there was a significant downsizing that occurred of the U.S. nuclear weapons complex. And I think that there was such a reaction to this in the Congress, and especially when the Republicans took over Congress, and a backlash to this, that there's, you know, sort of a desperate effort to keep money flowing into these sites. And this, in turn, is turning into a tail rake, you know, a nuclear weapons tail wagging our energy policy dog. It's not a very healthy situation.
And on top of that, we are focusing here on these materials that President Obama says he wants to control. I mean, there are two things here for me. I mean, A, that he's kind of cut the budget on that. And so that
No, in fairness, he has not. He's actually increased the budget on that.
But I thought he cut $2 million off this budget. What I was reading the other day. No?
Well, I mean, I haven't gone down to that level of detail, but what I've seen seems to be an increased effort to try to get control of these materials. But I think the point of it is this. A lot of the loose nukes that people are talking about, you know, if you set aside, which is very hard to do, Pakistan, North Korea, Iran, which seem to be on track to acquire nuclear weapons because of just their capabilities, a lot of this loose nuclear material was furnished by a large portion of it was furnished by the United States government under the Atoms for Peace program for research reactors. So we are now taking this stuff back in the form of spent, used research reactor fuel, and having the taxpayer pay the cost of disposing of this and bringing it back to our country in exchange for these research reactors use a less troublesome source of nuclear material, which in turn we're going to take back to keep their to keep them happy. This is also part. I mean, we have to be aware that the price we're paying to secure nukes and nuclear materials is also the price of having to dispose of these materials in our country.
One of the issues that are going to come up here, maybe I don't know how deeply it'll be discussed, but it's clear that. Angela Merkel, who's the leader of Germany, is going to raise the issue of dirty bombs. And she and people like Dr. Graham Nelson, others who worked under President Clinton's administration, have said this is the real issue we have to weigh. If we're worried about proliferation, but one of the areas we're not talking about is this area, and this is the greater danger, and we don't emphasize this at all.
Well, I think that's a very serious concern, because there are there's been an enormous proliferation of radioactive materials for use in medicine and research and various business applications.
Mm-hmm.
And the United States was one of the biggest peddlers of this, you know, and now we don't know for sure how many of these sources are out there, where they are, what's happened to them, and we're trying to get our arms around that problem. I would agree with you that this is a more likely route for a terrorist group to pursue, because the whole basic concept behind terrorism is to instill fear into populations. You know, one way to do that is to get one of these radioactive sources and put it in an area where there are a lot of people, subway or something like that, and cause a major disruption in that regard. And it is a very important concern. And it goes up against, again, this problem of promoting the uses of these materials as part of the, you know, sort of the historical process of the U.S. government and its atomic establishment and getting control of this stuff. And so there are other things, too, that you have to keep in mind in terms of, you know, radiological, potential radiological weapons. I mean, not the least of which is the vulnerability, potential vulnerability of the used nuclear fuel at nuclear power plants.
Right.
And one thing Germany has done, it did it 25 years ago in response to jet crashes, fighter jet crashes, NATO jet crashes, and acts of terror, was to take steps to much more safely secure and store its used nuclear fuel or spent fuel at its nuclear power plants. We, on the other hand, have been allowing nuclear power plants around the country to put much more spent fuel in their pools, which are not under any heavy containment.
Robert, we're running out of time. And I want to ask you one more very quick question before we have to take a break at the half. But I do want to ask you about, do you believe that the Obama administration has done enough moving towards what you just spoke about, securing, identifying, tracking all of this nuclear energy, this material, which in fact cuts the likelihood that a terrorist organization would be able to negotiate and get their hands on. I think that is a bottom line fear for a lot of folks in middle America and everywhere else.
Well, I think that with respect to materials that could be used as improvised nuclear weapons, the most serious danger is from highly enriched uranium, because these weapons are fairly easy to make and design and make on your own. And I think there's a very significant effort to collect all that stuff as much as quickly as possible, and that's a very good thing. There are a lot of sources out there that, radioactive sources, that is to say, that are throughout the society, that aren't as well protected, which could potentially be used to make radiological weapons that we have to be much more mindful of. And I think that at least in the lead up to this particular event, that aspect of the problem has not really surfaced.
Robert Alvarez, it's a pleasure to have you on the air with us. We look forward to having you back in a really good debate about this with some other guests. Senior scholar at the Institute for Policy Studies, it's been a pleasure to have you with us.
Thank you very much.
Take care, Robert.
Bye-bye.
We're going to take a very short break. I want to remind you the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by Urbanite, Baltimore's free magazine of ideas and innovation. This April's issue heads to the office with stories about jobs in the city, features including a look at Baltimore's past with a portrait of the lives of steelworkers in Sparrows Point during the post-war boom, as well as a conversation with urban development guru Ted Howard, who has a plan for putting Rust Belt cities back to work. Visit www.urbanitebaltimore.com. For a list of magazine pickup locations, we'll be right back. Welcome back. The Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the University of Maryland Women's Health for every stage of a woman's life, offering compassionate care and comprehensive obstetric and gynecological services from routine exams to specialized pelvic surgery. More information at 1-800-492-5538 or at www.umm.edu/Women's Center. I'm joined here by my co-host, Anthony McCarthy.
Great to be with you, Mark.
As always.
I was in D.C. over the weekend. The city was absolutely shut down with our previous conversation. Streets that normally, huge flows of traffic, when you bring 47 heads of states into the nation's capital, things with your traffic patterns change. And it's but a powerful conversation. I'm looking forward to us having a bigger conversation around that nuclear issue.
Yes,
that you mentioned to Alvarez.
And we're going to talk now about something very local.
Yeah.
But broader than local.
Very, very, very broad implications.
And as I've said to all of you, you know, when you are part of the Facebook world and you're on our Facebook page, I'm always looking to see what people are writing on the homepage. And one of the things was written by Keith Snipes, who is in Baltimore, has been known as a TV and radio host, actor, singer, activist in this community. He wrote this really interesting piece based around started off a conversation about the demonstrations being made downtown against hotels because of the danger of closing this hip-hop club that we talked about before on this program. But the conversation went beyond that, and Keith was writing about conversations he had with people who worked in those hotels, his own conversation with a restaurant owner when he noticed that that the new hires they had who were for waiters were all white. And he began this conversation, well, just whose downtown is it? Is it and in a majority African-American city? Who's downtown for? And I thought it was really kind of interesting. So we've invited Keith to join us here for the middle segment of our show to kind of wrestle this idea he's thrown out to a group of us on Facebook, including Michael Johnson and David Miller and others. And so, Keith, welcome. Good to have you here, man.
I'm glad to be here. Thanks for inviting me, Mark. Thank you, Anthony.
So why don't you run down what you were kind of positing on the – on Facebook.
Well, I started with a question. What is it going to take for black folks to stand up and recognize that there are some serious issues, not just in this city, but in this country, that need to be grappled with, and they need to be grappled with from a frontal perspective, not necessarily just on Facebook or at your kitchen table, but before those who can resolve these issues. The one that I wrote about in particular was my having been driving downtown, and I happened upon this protest that you mentioned earlier was about closing what you described as a hip-hop club. In the interest of full disclosure, I've never been there. I have no idea what kind of club it is, but I know this, that when I arrived there, a person who I trust imminently, who I ask, is there any reason for this club to be closed? Had it brought any negative attention on itself? And the person's reply to me was no. But then they shared to me something that I thought was even was most alarming, and that was that one of the executives that owns the Marriott Hotel, I'm not sure who this person is, but the language was very disturbing, that too many black people downtown causes culture shock. So I'm not sure what this person meant by culture shock, but when you put the words black people and culture shock in the same sentence in a city that is over 65% black, I have a problem with that.
I think that you make some very compelling points, Keith. And I think that in the previous show we had, there was obviously this very competing idea about perception and reality. The Velvet Rope is the club that we're talking about.
Right.
And on any given evening during the week and on weekends, large numbers of folks, like a lot of other clubs, frequent this club until it closes. And then those patrons file out into the street. Now, we have to be upfront about the fact that during our conversations here on this program and in the news, you just have to run the Velvet Rope, do a search of any of the media stories. There have been shootings that have been associated with the club. There have been obviously a lot of police action around the security of the club, so much so that the police commissioner for the city of Baltimore at one time within the last couple of months called for the padlocking and shutting down of this club. Now we find ourselves in a situation where the club's liquor license is up for dispute, whether or not it will be renewed. And I think that to use the words culture shock, I think those words were used in our program, and not just for blacks, that anyone would be shocked if you're staying in the Marriott or a hotel around this club and thousands of folks file out into the street. And that they are coming from a club where they've been partying, drinking, hyped up, having a good time, loud, and you're staying in one of those hotels. It has raised serious questions about the safety of the community and the impact of the quality of life around this club.
Sure.
Hotels have said that they've literally had to give back thousands of dollars to patrons to their hotels who have complained about not being able to sleep because the people are in the streets until 3:30, 4 o'clock in the morning. And so there appears to be, I'm disturbed by language, and I think I challenged Kirby Fowler about the idea that the appearance that we do not want young African-Americans in downtown Baltimore. And he said, well, you know, they've worked with this club and that the club has repeatedly violated the tenets of the agreements that they've come to. So I think that I agree with you. How much is it going to take for people to get upset and to demand answers? But I also have to add to the conversation, what's it going to take for people to keep their word, provide the kind of security that doesn't just protect the patrons, but protects the people around the club? And how much is it going to take for people in downtown, whether you are a white business owner or you're a minority business owner, to come together and really create a downtown where everybody feels welcome? Right now, what we have is a stalemate. When you have protests going on, and they've been going on for the last couple of weeks, and I understand there's going to be more at City Hall, where the liquor board's going to be protested. I'm not sure what kind of letter writing protests. I'm not sure if that's getting to the heart of the problem.
Let me be clear on this. I'm not interested in fighting to keep a club open. Mm-hmm. That is not what bothered me about this set of circumstances. What bothered me was, as you stated, the language, the notion that someone in such a powerful, influential position would say black people. He did not say anyone coming out of a club with this kind of behavior is tantamount to culture shock. His words, as I understand it, were allegedly, as I understand it, were too many black people downtown will cause culture shock. Now, this has historical implications, and this has future implications on how black people are dealt with in this city in totality and downtown in particular. I agree that unsavory behavior should not be tolerated, black, white, or psychedelic. It should not be tolerated. However, I think that any person who lives in this city has been black since they've lived in this city and has gone downtown Baltimore, they recognize an absence not only of black patrons, but black business. And I think that this kind of attitude might be the root cause of that absence. We're talking about economic implications here that are rooted in racism. And I believe that needs to be addressed.
Well, let me ask this question. I mean, this is interesting. I'll have listeners to join us here at 410-319-8888. And this is not just about the Velvet Rope, which is, and there are issues wherever it appears young people, no matter who they are, in numbers of thousands, can threaten other patrons just because the very nature of what they look like in the hip-hop world. And whether that's right or wrong, it just is. And we can address that and talk about that as well. But one of the things that's clear, if you go downtown, and like it's, people respond to this, you know, when you go to restaurants downtown, two things are interesting to me. One thing you brought up about the staff, unless you go to some places that I might frequent, like maybe at the Hellmann's or at or down in Fells Point at Stelios and Pauline Spiliotis' club. Why am I blocking?
The Black Olive.
The Black Olive. Mm-hmm. How can I block on that one? And others like that. You see, there's some places where you can actually see a black wait staff, and a black and white, a mixed wait staff.
Yes.
Most wait staffs in most restaurants are white.
Predominantly white.
So I was wondering, where the kids go to Morgan and Coppin? How come they're not also there? Part-time jobs waiting tables. So that's always been an issue.
What about those who don't go to Morgan or Coppin who simply need a job?
No, either, but I'm just saying because so many wait staffs are young kids. Not all, but a lot. Mm-hmm. But the other part is restaurants are usually all white or they're in a predominantly African-American part of town where the patrons are almost all black. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And this is one of those cities. You know, you go to D.C., you go to Busboys and Poets or some other restaurant in Washington. The crowds are highly mixed. There are black folks, Asian folks, Latino folks, white folks, old folks, young folks, gay folks, straight folks, all eating together in restaurants in Baltimore. What is it about the city that is majority African-American where the downtown does seem to be white? Do you know what I'm saying? It's not all completely that way, but I mean, that is a real issue. And I think that, and I wonder why you think that is, why we are such a separate city that way.
I think, Mark, that it is a historical, it's rooted in history. Baltimore, the fact that the Inner Harbor is here means that this certainly was an area where there was a active slave trade, and I think that the terms of race relations were developed early on. The problem is, as I indicated in that piece, black folks in Baltimore have been relatively quiet about these racialized realities, that we tend to see it, but then we act as if we don't. And again, this has economic implications. Unless we are prepared to have this conversation, and again, as I said earlier in the conversation, it says broader implications. It's not just about Baltimore. It's about this country. We tend to want to have conversations about race in the midst of a crisis. For example, when Imus made his now infamous statements, when Katrina was happening, we want to all of a sudden have a conversation about race. But then that conversation is truncated after the crisis is averted. We simply go on about our normally prescribed behaviors within this society as if nothing ever happened. So until we are ready, willing, and able to have this conversation about race, these things that tend to operate under the radar will continue to happen. And when we have one other thing, when we have this conversation about race, it can't be about the problems associated with black people. Black people cannot be looked at as people who are problems. Black people have to be looked at in some respect as people who have problems. But the first part of the conversation has to be about the flaws with this country that, again, are rooted in history. It's not about black people. Racism is about America.
Let's open the phones here. And I do want to kind of pursue this. Why in a place like Baltimore, where you have such a huge black middle class and a lot of successful folks, folks with well, good-paying jobs, jobs that pay well, why it seems so separate? You're talking about the Inner Harbor. The Inner Harbor is one of the few places you see any kind of mingling going on whatsoever. But in the rest of downtown, it doesn't exist. I mean, 410-319-8888. I know by the name, this is Doc Cheatham. You're on the air.
Good evening. Thank you so very, very much for
Doc,
taking my call. I really appreciate it. Keep you very much on point here. One of the things that we have requested, and I'm hoping my friend, the president of the Downtown Wannabe Partnership, is listening. We have formally and officially requested of the Downtown Partnership, as well as the City of Baltimore, that we immediately come to the table and begin having the type of dialogue that Keith is mentioning. What we mentioned in specific is what the NAACP has been doing since 1996, and that's what we call our Economic Reciprocity Initiative, and that is where we look at certain businesses and what we suggested to Kirby in this particular case. We would look at the businesses that are comprised in the Downtown Want to Be Partnership. We will look at one. Why do you have one board that has 20 people on it and there's only three blacks there? Why do you have another board that has 40 people on the board and there's only five blacks there, yet we're in a city that's predominantly African-American? Why is the ownership of the businesses in downtown so scarce with African American and women? Why is it that management and all of these businesses, for the most part, not reflective anywhere near what the community looks like, a predominantly African American community? Mention was made about hiring, not just hiring of college students, but hiring of African Americans mm-hmm. that live, in fact, in the city, the recruitment of such and the promotion of such. And then one of the major things is, what relationship does this downtown want to be partnership have with the community, which we know is little to none? So what we've asked for is that we sit down and we couch a process, a procedure, where we will be able to look at all of the business in the downtown partnership and say, we need to make improvements here. This area you're doing well. This area you're not doing anything at all. And collectively, the city of Baltimore, those organizations similar to ours, and the downtown partnership businesses would sit down and deal with an initiative to address what is very, very clear, some great inequities.
Doc, I mean, I think that this really kind of calls for a much deeper and longer discussions here on the air around the issues we're talking about here. I mean, I think that, when you mentioned organizations having only two black board members, now let's go back to that one little, the one thing of the many things you just said that encompass the entire issue. I mean, look, in Baltimore, sometimes I feel like we're still back in like 1964 on some levels.
Well, you know, I'm really appreciative of you having this discussion because I, in fact, was in the meeting where the culture shock was actually mentioned. Mm.
That really happened. I'm not saying Keith was not saying any of that, but it really happened.
I was physically there, and it was actually said by a police officer, a high-ranking police officer. That's where it came from. That's where it originated. The two managers of the two small hotels. Let's not think that we're talking about the Marriott Waterfront or the other Marriott. We're talking about a smaller Marriott. Those two general managers basically were concurring that, in fact, there was a culture shock. And did we have a clear understanding of what culture shock means? And Keith hit it perfectly. If you're talking about African Americans and coming out in the street, what type of culture shock are you discussing? So let me get off to say, we need a major discussion. Kirby Fowler and the Want to Be Downtown Partnership, you are now very, very suspect as to your very being. It's time we sat down with the city and had a serious discussion about what y'all are and are not doing here in the Baltimore City.
Well, I think we would offer this program here for 2 hours to have a discussion like that or more with as many people as we need to have on the air, Doc, including you, obviously.
I think that would be great, Mark. I really do.
As soon as the WEA fund drive is over next week, after we do it through that, we can do that. Let's plan that for when we finish the fund drive. We still here in Baltimore have, we talk about the Greater Baltimore Committee, GBC, which is the largest business community, business group. But you also have the Business Roundtable. Now, I'm one of those who believes that minority communities, which minority community you are, needs its own institutions for lots of reasons. I mean, because of the nature we live in. But it still feels like we're in another era where you have a group made up of almost all white business leaders, and you have another group made up of almost all black business leaders, and that if you're talking about a city that is a multiracial city with a majority African-American population, that you need some integration at the top, the middle, and the bottom of the organization, that this is going to work.
I'll close with this, Mark, so you can take some more calls. Yeah. We have had within the last 9 months 4 separate instances. One where a group of people in Little Italy did not want a business in there because it was not Italian. We had another instance down in Fells Point where they said it was not the type of business that they wanted. What we're talking about is an African-American restaurant. We have a place where slaves actually came through a train stop, and we were told by not only the organization in that area but also the city councilman that we needed to move that location somewhere else. And then here recently, we're being told that, yes, we can have clubs that's down in Marketplace where if you go to the parking lot, you will see sex being had. You will hear beer cans, beer bottles all in the parking lot, but you see no mention or hear any mention of that. That not only are we getting a different type of organization, but we're getting reporting that does not even take place. TV and news cameras aren't even coming to what's also happening in the other part of downtown.
Doc, I'm glad you're part of the show. I need to get you in the studio, though, man.
Got
to get you in the studio.
God bless y'all.
Take care. Keith, I'm going to go to the phone. Why don't you make a comment, then we'll go open the
well,
phone.
Well, I wanted to get back to your mention of the black middle class. Yes, Baltimore does have a relatively vast black middle class. However, I think there is that old stigma of once you make it, you're gone. Subsequently, there is a drain on resources, intellectual resources, experiential resources, those kinds of skills and tools that are necessary to fight effectively what we're talking about. And unless those in the middle class see themselves part and parcel to those who are not in the middle class, those who some consider the lower class, which to me is fundamentally derogatory, but nonetheless, economically, the economic disparities are clear. Unless those folks see themselves as part of this fight, then it's going to be very, very ineffective. And until we recognize that when someone says, too many black people downtown is culture shock, they're not talking about just black people who are not economically well-to-do. They are talking about people who look like me.
Right. Right. Exactly. Let's go back to the phones. 410-319-8888. Your thoughts, I think let's go to we have Chris, Jim, Linda, I think in that order, or Chris, yes, and we'll come to your calls. Chris and the others we'll get to as well. Chris, you're on the air.
Good afternoon, gentlemen.
Good afternoon, Chris.
I'm listening to the conversation. I agree with everything that was said. Let me say that first. But it seems like the conversation of race in Baltimore, race period, anywhere.
Yeah.
It reminds me of watching Star Trek when they would play chess on that multi-level chess game.
Tough game to
play. And there's so many faces, so many different levels to it. It seems like when the conversation begins, we tend to stay on one level.
Yeah.
And there's so many other things at play. Just like I agree with the obviously I'm an African-American man. I agree, and I've been in a position with dealing with the police when I go to Fells Point. Now, I looked into, because I'm not from Baltimore, I looked into the history of Fells Point. When I realized some of the history of Fells Point, I no longer go to Fells Point. Not for entertainment. But having said that, I also have to acknowledge some of the things that do go on when, I don't know, I'm going to put it the way I put it. When hip-hop events go on and different things go on, I'm not even sure how to put this. It's like we still have these issues within our community that we need to talk to each other to work out. Mm-hmm. But then we have to talk to the other people to work out our cross-cultural issues. But the problem I really have is that white people in Baltimore don't talk about their own issues within their own perspective. It's easy for other people to look at us and say, you guys need to get together. And then we all say to each other, yeah, we got to get together. But wait a minute. They need to talk to each other about race. We never see a discussion of race only involving white people talking about white people. And I think that can bring out some of the issues that can more, like I said, I'm really having a hard time putting how I see this forth. But
it's interesting that you point that. Maybe that's it. Let me respond to that for just a second. That's an interesting thought. I mean, I think the difference is that, I mean, I've never noticed a conversation among just white folks by themselves about race unless it's around an incident of some kind. I mean, I think that's the case. I mean, maybe that's not true either. It depends on the group you're with. I mean, I think there are people in this community who are very sensitive to stuff and are always wrestling with these issues. And I think that it's I hear what you're saying. I think it's almost more important for people to have this dialogue with one another in a non-threatening atmosphere if we're going to accomplish something.
Sure.
And really move it ahead. But I think the part of it is just it's also the practical everyday living and working. You know? I mean, that we are still a very separate society. Let me be fair to listeners. I promise I'll go to other people calling in and come back to our guests. Who do we say we're going to next? Do you remember what I said? I said who? 410-319-80. Oh, Jim.
Jim,
thanks. Jim. Jim, you're on the air.
Hi, how are you doing?
Well.
Hey, so the point I really wanted to make is that, you know, I agree with the previous caller with most of what's been said, but I don't think at all of what we're talking about is necessarily about racism. I think it is more about poor versus wealthy or urban versus suburban. If you really look at it from the perspective of people that go down into the city that come from the suburbs, they look at it. I don't think that most people in this day look at the color of somebody's skin and jump to a conclusion. It's so much as they look at the area they're in, how run down it is, how many liquor stores and how many, you know, Chinese restaurants and run down, you know, I guess row homes there are that are boarded up around them, you know, and then they think this is an unsavory area. And people just in their mind kind of associate that with a certain, I guess, people that look in a certain way, not necessarily people that have skin that's black, but people that dress in an urban way. You associate that with them. You have, by no fault of your own, you're not necessarily racist because of it, but it you associate it with violence. You associate it with, you associate it with hatred. You know, it's kind of a it's something that your mind just does. You know what I mean? And, you know, that's why, obviously, when someone's making a comment that there's too many black people downtown, that's a disgusting thing. But, you know, I don't think necessarily that everything you've been talking about is, you know, because of racism. I think it's more of a class divide.
All right. Anthony was trying to respond to you, I think.
Well, Jim, I think that you make our point that I think too often, and I'm not trying to say that white people have a need to make excuses for each other. I do think that white people are tired, almost to the point of distraction, of conversations that make them uncomfortable about racism. Jim just spent a minute explaining why, when you drive through poor areas that are abandoned and that people dress a certain way and that they're you feel uncomfortable, why you draw in your mind a conclusion about who lives there. He said it's a class distinction, but it's not a class distinction. It's Jim's discomfort around race. We don't want to believe that when we make assumptions about people, Jim went as far as to say he doesn't believe that people look at people and make assumptions, look at people's color and make an assumption about who they are. We do. And it's frightening because we can't move past, or we can't have an honest conversation about how Doc Cheatham says we got to bring everybody to the table for a conversation. You can't bring people to the table for a conversation if they're not going to admit that we are dealing with race and racism. Class is, of course, a part of this conversation. Middle class, we talked about middle class African Americans, have a very particular feeling about hip hop culture. But unless people, white people and black people, are going to have an honest conversation about how we feel about race, about the assumptions we make about race, about the realities of who we want around us, where we live, where we socialize, where we eat, like you talked about restaurants, are based on race, then we're not going to have a productive conversation if Doc Cheatham gets everybody around the table. What we're going to do is put a Band-Aid on a historic, long, festering scar on this country, but we're never going to get to the point of healing that scar because people like Jim believe that we don't make distinctions based on race anymore.
Well, we have to take a short break and come back. We're going to stay with this topic for another 10 or 15 minutes before we have to switch and talk about the race to the top. Because one of our guests for that program can only stay till 6:30. We want to make sure he has his voice in because he's anti-race to the top. We want to get a point of view in this conversation. You stay with us. We'll be right back with Keith Snipes and, of course, my partner in crime, Anthony McCarthy. And we'll come right back. The Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the Maryland State Mortgage Late Don't Wait program. For more information and personal counseling, the number is 1-877-462-7555. Hold on, folks. We're coming back. Welcome back. I'm Mark Steiner.
I'm Anthony McCarthy.
And we're here with our friend Keith Snipes, who started this ruckus by writing this stuff on Facebook that he wrote But it's a good thing.
Mm-hmm.
And the number here is 410-319-8888. Unless we want to pick up what we talked about off mic, let's just jump right back and get folks right in here. Linda, you're on the air.
I was listening to a number of the statements that were made earlier, but I seem to feel that Baltimore has become much more segregated now than it was 40 years ago. 40 years ago, it wasn't unusual to see mixed crowds downtown at various clubs and restaurants, but that's no longer the case. And I also know that someone mentioned before that yes, this is about race, and someone else said that it was about cultural difference. But you also, I think, have to take age into consideration either. I don't think black middle-class people of a certain age really appreciate hip-hop culture either. And I'll be honest, I am one that is offended by the language and by the behavior of the young people. And I think some of the parents of these young people would probably be surprised at what they would hear coming out of the mouths of their children. And when they're all sitting up in church Sunday morning, pretending that, you know, they're being good and doing the right thing. But I don't think anybody wants to go downtown and be confronted by a group of 50 foul-mouthed kids. I also think that middle-class black Americans who are younger than I am, and I'm 60, sort of had a tendency.
You're young.
Well,
I like that. No, I'm sorry. Go ahead, Bill. I'm sorry.
You know, push me into the nursing home. Those that may be in their 40s or so have a tendency not to be interested in anything that is not Afrocentric. So if it's not their music, if it's not their culture, they're not interested. Whereas those of us of an older generation with a different type of education who have been exposed to more things tend to feel more comfortable with all kinds of people.
Linda, you raised that we don't have a little bit of time for this segment, so I want to let Keith and Anthony come back and comment. I mean, I think that we're about of the same generation close by, and I think there is a very strange phenomenon that I'll just throw out here to consider for another time. Of people in their late 50s to mid-60s in this city we're broadcasting from, Baltimore, is that we grew up in a time where there were actually integrated schools, when black and white folks went to school together for a very brief, powerful period from like 1960 to maybe 67 or so. But it wasn't that long, you know. People who went to City, who went to Poly, went to Forest Park, who went to Patterson, who went to Garrison Junior High School, Pimlico Junior High School, a number of schools. And so your experiences were different. And your friendships sometimes lasted way beyond that time. And we are in a hyper-segregated area now where we had this brief time that no longer exists. I think that plays into this as well. And I'm very curious how we would – because I asked you both this question, because I don't think you can legislate integrating downtown. Maybe you can. Maybe I'm wrong about that. But so how does it happen? How does that become a place that goes beyond the City Cafe or go beyond a few of the other places where people actually gather that are where people, you know, of different ethnicities actually meet and people with different gay and straight actually meet in one place. You don't have that. I mean, that's the way it happens. I mean, look at North Avenue, the Arts District. The Arts District going up Charles Street. You know, you have – when you go past the Charles Theater, which I love to go to, that from there, that little block down, that's all white. As soon as you cross that street, it's all black. Sure. Then it becomes all white again with all these young white hip establishments opening up on North Avenue. You go left and it's white. You go right and it's black. So, I mean – and so – so tell me how does that change?
I think, Mark, that and I want to start my brief comments with something that Linda said about hip-hop. Hip-hop grew from a need to have an alternative expression to what it means to be an American. I think that young black people thought to themselves, I don't fit into this prescribed notion of the ideal American. Therefore, there was an alternative expression developed, and it became hip-hop. As negative as some of it might be, I think it would do us well to understand the roots of hip-hop and what does it mean in the larger scheme of this country. What are we offering our young people as legitimate means of expression as an alternative to hip-hop? That's the question I think we ought to be asking ourselves. In terms of our trying to close this divide, I think it's both a civics lesson and a cultural shift. I think that the civics lesson has to start at the community level, in neighborhoods where black people in particular are told, you matter. You are a part of this city. What you do or what you don't do has implications on this city. Downtown is as much yours as it is anyone else's. So that first part needs to be dealt with first.
Right.
And then the cultural shift has to come with that all-inclusive conversation between whomever wants to be involved, the downtown merchants, the mayor, the governor, if he wants to be involved. There needs to be this broad cultural discussion. What is it that is going to allow for all of us to be able to come together and enjoy the amenities that this city has to offer? At this point, there is a de facto sign downtown that says black people need not show up. That is why you see so few people downtown. And even at the Inner Harbor, there is predominantly whites downtown at the Inner Harbor, one of the nicest, one of the jewels of this city where black people used to go quite often, but now very rarely go. I know plenty of black people in this city who say, I don't go to the harbor. Well, I think the reason they don't go is not because there's nothing to do, but because they don't feel like they belong there. So we need to change that perception that black people don't belong downtown, and then we need to put actions behind those words.
Anthony?
No. I mean, I get airtime all the time. We have a lot of callers.
Because we do have to switch gears here in a minute. One of our guests is on the phone waiting. We want to get to the other conversation. I mean, and I'm still very much bothered by this idea that a ranking police officer with hotel managers not in agreement would say it's a culture shock when black folks are downtown. That to me, is a disturbing mindset. That we need to
and it's
with.
Broader.
Not to beat up on folk, but to just it can be dealt with without beating up people. I think
mm-hmm. I agree.
I think that City Hall should find out who that ranking officer is
and have a conversation.
Absolutely.
410-319-8888. Let's see, who are we waiting for? I've been out here a long time. Eric, you're on the air. Eric, you there?
Very much. Yes, I'm here.
You're on the air.
Thank you very much for taking my call. Mm-hmm. I just had a brief comment. I am a young African-American, middle class, and new to the Baltimore area. And I would just like to think and add to the conversation that
sure.
It is a matter of perception, I believe. You had mentioned earlier that when you go to D.C., there are all races and all cultures intermingling.
In certain neighborhoods, yes, right.
Right, whereas here in Baltimore, I think the biggest image that you have of the city is the HBO TV Wire, which was a great show, but it was very negative in its perception of what Baltimore is. And image becomes reality, and it becomes a self-perpetuating kind of a thing where, you know, if you have money and you're upwardly mobile, I mentioned to people that I meet, they say, where do you live? I say, Baltimore. They say, why? So it's a perception thing here. And I'm originally from Cleveland, Ohio, and you have everything that Cleveland has and even more, but it's just a matter of from the mayor on down communicating a positive message about the city, having different types of businesses that welcome different types of races all together planned out in a coordinated.
Eric, I'm with you. Hold on. Thank you so much for your call. Let's get another comment. And Deborah, is it Deborah? You're on the air. Deborah, are you there?
Yes, I am.
You're on the air.
Thank you for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I'm calling on behalf of my daughter, 17-year-old, that they went to the harbor this past Saturday. And that's where these 17 and 16-year-olds go, and they actually go to nice restaurants and spend
yes.
a fair amount of money.
Right.
But she shared at 9:30, the helicopters were flying by, and they were the cops were on the ground, and they were stomping every youth. And they said, if you're under 17, then you must leave. And she said, I'm so glad I'm 17 years old. And I had to show ID, and this was 9:30 Saturday. And so her comment was, what are these tourists thinking when they see the helicopters flying by at the harbor?
And these are all children, you're saying black children?
These were black children. She's a black child that go to City College. And they didn't have to leave, but they were just cleaning up the harbor. And her comment was, I thought the curfew was later than that. So it was the helicopters flying over. There was nothing going on, you know, the helicopters flying over. The cops on the ground, and it was, you have to be over 17 to stay at the harbor without an adult, 9:30 at night.
That, ACLU, here you go. I mean, they're going to be...
Mark, that is alarming.
That's very alarming.
That is alarming.
I mean, you know, if you're... The problem is, if you're young and black, you're seen as a threat. Even if you're... on your way to get 800s on your SATs and getting a full scholarship to Harvard University.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so
yeah.
that and but it was said on the show. I respect our police commissioner a great deal, but he said on this program that they're going to make this push to clean up the Inner Harbor. And so that push means
black kids.
Right. No
That's what it means.
That's what it means.
That's exactly it means ethnic cleansing.
But
that's what it means.
But to his credit, the African American mayor at that time, Mark, said she agreed with him that they had to crack down on the Inner Harbor.
Right. The mayor you said.
That's right. So he was taking his direction and was just agreeing with the African American leadership of the
folks,
city.
Folks, we do have to take a break here. Clarence, you've been holding on for a long time. A very quick thought from you, then we have to take a break to move on.
Hello?
Clarence, very quick thought.
This whole thing about racism downtown it derives itself from the economic racism. If you look at that area down there, you would not believe how much disposable income runs through Federal Hill, Canton, and right on around the L through that into the Inner Harbor. And these people feel as though that this is theirs, that the Inner Harbor mm-hmm. belongs to them, and they don't mm-hmm. want anything else down there. I'm a cab driver. I see it every night, and I was witness to what your last caller said about the police were cleaning up. That's where it all comes from. Who is the fault for this? The people who have been running City Hall for these years.
That's right.
Well, and I know that's true. I mean, I've heard these stories. I mean, my grandson could be one of those kids in the Inner Harbor who they're trying to clear out. You know, and his sister, my granddaughter. I mean, that stuff is too real. So, folks. We do have to switch gears. We have guests lined up for a different discussion, which we're going to come to about our schools. All of you 5, 6, 7, 8 people who are holding on, we will come back to this discussion. I think it's a very important one for us to have. And Keith Snipes, I appreciate you being on the show and causing
Thank
so much trouble.
Thank you so much,
appreciate
Keith.
It.
Creative trouble.
Enjoy trouble. Thanks, Mark.
Good to have you
Thanks.
Here.
Thank you, Keith.
Anthony and I will be right back to continue this conversation. We'll remind you, The Mark Steiner Show is made possible by Johns Hopkins Medicine. For the 19th consecutive year, the Johns Hopkins Hospital is ranked number one by U.S. News & World Report in their annual Best Hospital Survey. Find out more about the nation's top hospital at hopkinsmedicine.org. Race to the top? Is it really that good? That's the debate coming up next. Stay with us.